attention, wondering if he'd missed something important. May the light's blessing be upon him in every thought, word, and deed, so that he may thrive beneath it, and grow to serve it as its paladin. Arthas felt a sudden, calming warmth flow through him as the blessing was laid upon him. The stiffness and soreness vanished, leaving him refreshed and at peace. The bishop turned to the queen and the princess. May the light shine on her royal majesty, Lian Menethil, that she... Arthas grinned and waited for the bishop to complete the individual blessings. He'd name the girl then. Arthas leaned against the back room of the wall. And we humbly request the light's blessing on Lady Jaina Proudmoore. May she be blessed with its healing and wisdom that she... Aha! The mystery girl was a mystery no longer. Jaina Proudmoore, a year younger than he, daughter to Admiral Daelin Proudmoore, naval war hero and ruler of Kul Tiras. What did intrigue him was why she was here and... And that her studies at Dalaran go well. We ask that she become a representative of the light, and that in the role of a mage, she will serve her people well and truly. That made sense. She was on her way to Dalaran, the beautiful city of Magi not too far from Capital City. Knowing the rigid rules of etiquette and hospitality that were so pervasive in royal and noble circles, she'd be here for a few days before traveling on. This, he thought, could be fun. At the end of the service, Arthas, already located near the door, stepped out first. Muradin and Trollbane were the first out, both looking slightly relieved that the service was over. Taranis, Uther, Lian, Kalia, and Jaina followed. Both his sister and the Proudmoore girl were fair-haired and slender, but the resemblance stopped there. Kalia was delicately boned, with a face right out of old paintings, pale-skinned and soft. Jaina, however, had bright eyes and a lively smile, and she moved like someone who was well accustomed to riding and hiking. She obviously spent a great deal of time out of doors, as her face was tanned with a smattering of sprinkles across her nose. This, Arthas decided, was a girl who would not mind getting a snowball in the face or going for a swim on a hot day. Someone unlike his sister, he could play with.
Arthas, a word with ye, came a gruff voice.
Arthas turned to see the ambassador peering up at him.
Of course, sir, Arthas said, his heart sinking. All he wanted to do was talk to this new friend. He was already sure they would get along famously, and Muradin probably wanted to scold him again for the embarrassing display earlier in the armory. At least the dwarf was discreet enough to walk a few paces away. He turned to face the prince, stubby thumbs hooked into his belt, gruff face knotted in thought.
Lad, he said, I'll get right to the point. Your fighting form is terrible.
Again, Arthas felt the blood rush to his face. I know, he said, but father...
Your father has many things on his mind. Didn't you be saying the thing against him?
Well, what was he supposed to say?
Well, I can't very well teach myself fighting. You saw what happened when I tried.
I can, I'll teach ye, if you like.
You will?
Arthas was at first disbelieving, then delighted. The dwarves were renowned for their fighting prowess, among many things. Part of Arthas wondered if Muradin would also teach him how to hold his ale, another thing dwarves were known for. But he decided not to ask that.
Aye, that's what I said, wasn't it? I spoke with your father, and he's all for it. Been put off long enough as it is. But let's get one thing straight. I'll take no excuses, and I'll be pushing you right hard. And if at any moment I say to myself, Muradin, you're wasting your time, I stop. Do you agree, boy?
Arthas fought back an incongruous giggle at the thought of someone who stood so much shorter than he, calling him boy, but bit it back.
Yes, sir, he said fervently.
Muradin nodded and stuck out a large, calloused hand. Arthas shook it. Grinning, he glanced up at his father, who was deep in conversation with Uther. They turned as one to regard him, both pairs of eyes narrowing in speculation, and inwardly Arthas sighed. He knew that look. So much for playing with Jaina. He'd probably not have time to even see her again before she left. He turned to watch as Kalia, her arm around the younger girl's shoulder, swept Jaina from the room. But right before she disappeared through the doorway, Admiral Proudmoore's daughter turned her golden head, caught Arthas's gaze with her own, and smiled. Chapter 3
"I'm very proud of you, Arthas," said his father, "stepping up to the responsibility like this."
In the week that Jaina Proudmoore had been with the Menethil family as an honored guest, responsibility had been the watchword. Not only had his training with Muradin begun, and it was every bit as rigorous and demanding as the dwarf had warned, the pain of sore muscles and bruises augmented by the occasional ringing cuff on the ear when Arthas was not paying sufficient attention for Muradin's liking. But as Arthas had feared, Uther and Tyrannus also decided it was time that the prince's training was stepped up in other areas. Arthas would rise before dawn, grab a quick breakfast of bread and cheese, and go on an early ride with Muradin. The ride would end in a hike, and it was the 12-year-old youth who always ended up shaking and winded. Arthas secretly wondered if the dwarves had such an affinity with stones that the very earth made it easy for them to climb it. Back home, bath, lessons in history, mathematics, and calligraphy. A midday meal, then it was all afternoon in the chapel with Uther, praying, meditating, and discussing the nature of paladins and the rigorous disciplines they must observe. Dinner, and then Arthas stumbled into bed to sleep the deep, dreamless sleep of the utterly exhausted. He'd seen Jaina only a few times at dinner, and she and Kalia seemed to be thick as thieves. Arthas finally decided enough was enough, and, taking the lessons in history and politics that were being drilled into his head, he approached his father and Uther with the offer to escort their guest, Lady Jaina Proudmoore, to Dalaran himself. He didn't bother to tell them it was because he wanted to get out of his duties. It pleased Tyrannus to think of his son as being so responsible. Jaina smiled brightly at the prospect, and it got Arthas exactly what he wanted. Everyone was happy. And so it was that in early summer, when the flowers were blooming, the woods were full of game, and the sun danced above them in a sky of bright blue, Prince Arthas Menethil was accompanying a brightly smiling blonde young lady on a journey to the wondrous city of Magi. They'd gotten a little late of a start. One thing Arthas was starting to learn about Jaina Proudmoore was that she was not exactly punctual, but Arthas didn't mind. He was in no hurry. They weren't alone, of course. Propriety demanded that Jaina's lady-in-waiting and a guard or two ride escort. But still, the servants hung back and let the two young nobles become acquainted. They rode for a while, then stopped for a picnic lunch. While they were munching on bread, cheese, and watered wine, one of Arthas's men came up to him.
"Sir, with your permission, we will make preparations to spend the night in Ambermill. On the morrow we can push on the rest of the way to Dalaran. We should arrive there by nightfall."
Arthas shook his head. "No, let's continue. We can camp overnight in the Hillsbrad area. That will get Lady Jaina to Dalaran by mid-morning tomorrow." He turned to smile at her. She smiled back, though he caught a hint of disappointment in her eyes.
"Are you sure, sir? We've planned on accepting the hospitality of the locals, not subjecting the lady to sleeping out in the open."
"It's fine, Kaven," Jaina spoke up. "I'm not a fragile little figurine."
Arthas's smile widened into a grin. He hoped she'd feel that way in a few hours. While the servants set up camp, Arthas and Jaina
went exploring. They scrambled up a hill that gave them an unparalleled view. To the west, they could see the little farming community of Ambermill and even the distant spires of Baron Silverlane's keep. To the east, they could almost make out Dalaran itself, and more clearly, the internment camp to its south. Since the end of the Second War, the orcs had been rounded up and placed into these camps. It was more merciful than simply slaughtering them on sight, Terranus had explained to Arthas. And besides, the orcs seemed to be suffering from a strange malaise. Most of the time when humans stumbled upon them or hunted them, they fought only half-heartedly and went into internment peacefully. There were several camps just like this one. They had a rustic meal of roasted rabbit on a spit and retired shortly after dark. Once he was assured that everyone was asleep, Arthas threw a tunic over his breeches and quickly tugged on his boots. As an afterthought, he took one of his daggers and fastened it to his belt, then crept over to Jaina.
"Jaina," he whispered, "wake up."
She awoke in silence and unafraid, her eyes glinting in the moonlight. He squatted back as she sat up, putting a finger to his lips. She spoke in a whisper.
"Arthas, is something wrong?"
He grinned. "You up for an adventure?" She tilted her head.
"What sort of an adventure?"
"Trust me." Jaina looked at him for a moment, then nodded.
"All right."
She, like all of them, had gone to sleep mostly dressed and simply needed to pull on her boots and cloak. She rose, made a half-hearted attempt to comb her fingers through her blonde hair, and nodded. Jaina followed him as they ascended the same ridge they had explored earlier that day. The climb was more challenging at night, but the moonlight was quite bright, and their feet did not slip. "There's our destination," he said, pointing. Jaina gulped.
"The internment camp?
Have you ever seen one up close?"
"No, and I don't want to."
He frowned, disappointed.
"Come on, Jaina. It's our one chance to get a good look at an orc. Aren't you curious?"
Her face was hard to read in the moonlight, her eyes dark pools of shadow.
They killed Derek, my older brother.
One of them killed Varian's father, too. They've killed a lot of people, and that's why they're in these camps.
It's the best place for them.
A lot of people don't like the fact that my father is raising taxes to pay for the camps, but come on and judge for yourself. I missed a chance to get a good look at Doomhammer when he was in the Undercity. I don't want to miss a chance to see one now. She was silent, and at last he sighed. All right, I'll take you back.
No, she said, surprising him. Let's go.
Quietly, they made their descent.
All right, Arthas whispered. When we were up here earlier, I made note of their patrols. It doesn't look like they're much different at night, except maybe even more infrequent. With the orcs not having much spirit left in them, I guess the guards think that the chances of escape aren't that likely.
He smiled at her reassuringly.
Which works out well for us.
Other than patrols, someone is always stationed in those two watchtowers.
They're the ones we have to be most careful of, but hopefully they'll be looking for any disturbance to come from the front rather than behind, since the camp backs up against the sheer wall face. Now, let this fellow here complete his circuit, and we should have ample time to get close to that wall right there and take a good look.
They waited for the bored-looking guard to meander past, then a few more breaths after that.
"Put your hood up," Arthas said.
Both had fair hair, and it would be far too easy for the guards to spot. Jaina looked nervous, but excited, and obeyed. Fortunately, both she and Arthas wore cloaks of a dark shade.
"Ready?"
She nodded.
"Good. Let's go."
They slipped quickly and quietly down the rest of the way. Arthas held her back for a moment, until the guard in the tower was looking in the other direction, then motioned to her. They ran forward, making sure their hoods were securely in place, and a few steps later, they were pressing against the wall of the camp. The camps were rough, but efficient. They were made of wood, little more than logs fastened together, sharpened at the top and embedded deep into the ground. There were plenty of chinks in the wall that a curious boy and girl could look through. It was hard to see at first, but there were several large shapes inside. Arthas turned his head for a better look. They were orcs, all right. Some of them were on the ground, curled up and covered by blankets. Some walked here and there, almost aimlessly like animals in cages, but lacking a caged beast's almost palpable yearning for freedom. Over there was what looked like a family unit, a male, a female, and a young one. The female, slighter and shorter than the male, held something small to her chest, and Arthas realized it was an infant.
"Oh," whispered Jaina beside him, "they look so sad."
Arthas snorted, then remembered the need to be quiet. He quickly glanced up at the tower, but the guard had heard nothing.
"Sad? Jaina, these brutes destroyed Stormwind. They wanted to render humankind extinct. They killed your brother for light's sake.
Don't waste any pity on them."
"Still, somehow I didn't think they would have children," Jaina continued. "Do you see the one with the baby?"
"Well, of course they have children. Even rats have children," Arthas said. He was irritated, but then maybe he should have expected a reaction like that from an 11-year-old girl.
"They look harmless enough. Are you sure they belong here?"
She turned her face to his, a white oval in the moonlight, seeking his opinion.
"It's expensive to keep them here. Maybe they should be released."
"Jaina," he said, keeping his voice soft, "they're killers. Even if right now they're lethargic, who can say what would happen if they're released?" She sighed softly in the darkness and didn't answer. Arthas shook his head. He'd seen enough. The guard would be back shortly. "Ready to go back?" She nodded, stepping away and running quickly with him back toward the hill. Arthas glanced over his shoulder and saw the guard start to turn. He dove toward Jaina, grabbed her around the waist, and shoved her to the ground, hitting hard beside her.
"Don't move," he said. "The guard is looking right at us."
Despite the rough fall, Jaina was smart enough to freeze at once. Carefully, keeping his face as shadowed as possible, Arthas turned his head to look at the guard. He couldn't see a face at this distance, but the man's posture bespoke boredom and weariness. After a long moment, during which Arthas heard his heart thundering in his ears, the guard turned to face the other direction. "Sorry about that," Arthas apologized, helping Jaina to her feet. "You all right?"
"Yes," Jaina said.
She grinned at him. They were back in their respective sleeping areas a few moments later. Arthas looked up at the stars, completely satisfied. It had been a good day. Late that next morning, they arrived at Dalaran. Arthas had never been there before, though of course he had heard a great deal about it. The Magi were a private and mysterious lot, quite powerful, but they kept to themselves, save when needed. Arthas remembered when Khadgar had accompanied Anduin Lothar and Prince, now King, Varian Wrynn, to speak with Taranis, to warn them of the orcish threat. His presence had lent weight to Anduin's statements, and with good reason. Magi of the Kirin Tor didn't get involved in ordinary politics. Nor did they do the ordinary political maneuvering, such as inviting royalty to enjoy their hospitality. It was only because Jaina was coming to study that Arthas and his retinue were permitted admittance. Dalaran was beautiful, even more glorious than Capital City. It seemed almost impossibly clean and bright, as a city based so deeply on magic ought to be. There were several graceful towers reaching skyward, their bases white stone, and their apexes violet encircled with gold. Many had radiant, hovering stones dancing around them. Others had windows of stained glass that caught the sunlight. Gardens bloomed,
the fragrances from wild, fantastical flowers, providing a scent so heady, Arthas was almost dizzy. Or maybe it was the constant thrum of magic in the air that caused the sensation. He felt very ordinary and dingy as they rode into the city, and almost wished they hadn't slept outside last night. If they had stayed at Ambermill, at least he'd have had a chance to have bathed. But then he and Jaina wouldn't have gotten a chance to spy on the internment camp. He glanced at his companion. Her blue eyes were wide with awe and excitement, her lips slightly parted. She turned to Arthas, those lips curving in a smile.
"Aren't I lucky to be studying here?"
"Sure," he said, smiling on her behalf. She was drinking this in like one who had been given water after a week in the desert, but he felt unwanted. He clearly did not have the affinity for wielding magic as she did.
"I'm told that outsiders aren't usually welcome," she said. "I think that's a shame. It would be nice to see you again."
She blushed, and for a moment, Arthas forgot about the intimidation the city emanated, and heartily agreed that it would be nice to see Lady Jaina Proudmoore again, too.
"Very nice indeed."
"Again, you little gnome girl! I'll pull your pigtails, you oof!"
The shield caught the taunting dwarf full in the helmed face, and he actually stumbled back a step or two. Arthas slashed with the sword, grinning beneath his own helm as it connected solidly. Then suddenly, he was sailing through the air to land hard on his back. His vision was filled with the image of a looming head with a long beard, and he was barely able to lift his blade in time to parry. With a grunt, he pulled his legs into his chest and then extended them hard, catching Muradin in the gut. This time, it was the dwarf who went hurtling backward. Arthas brought his legs down swiftly and leaped up in a single smooth motion, charging his teacher who was still on the ground, coming at him with blow after blow, until Muradin spoke the words that Arthas honestly never thought he'd hear.
"I yield!"
It took everything Arthas had to halt the strike, pulling up and back so abruptly he lost his balance and stumbled. Muradin lay where he was, his chest rising and falling. Fear squeezed Arthas's heart.
"Muradin? Muradin!"
A hearty chuckle escaped from the thick bronze beard.
"Well done, lad. Well done indeed."
He struggled to sit up, and Arthas was there, reaching out a hand to help haul the dwarf to his feet. Muradin pumped the hand happily.
"So, you were paying attention after all when I taught him a special trick."
Relieved and pleased with the praise, Arthas grinned. Some of what Muradin taught him would be repeated, honed, and reinforced in his paladin training. But other things, well, he didn't think Uther the Lightbringer would know about feet planted firmly in the belly, or the rather handy trick regarding the efficacy of a broken wine bottle. There was fighting, and there was fighting. And Muradin Bronzebeard seemed determined that Arthas Minnithil would understand all aspects of it. Arthas was 14 now, and had been training with Muradin several times a week, save for when the dwarf was away on diplomatic errands. At first, it had gone as both parties had expected, badly. Arthas left the first dozen or so sessions bruised, bloodied, and limping. He had stubbornly refused any offers of healing, insisting that the pain was part of the process. Muradin had approved, and he had shown it by pressing Arthas all the harder. Arthas never complained, not even when he wanted to, not even when Muradin scolded him or pressed the attack long after Arthas was too exhausted to even hold up a shield. And for that stubborn refusal to whine or to quit, he was rewarded twofold. He learned, and learned well, and he won the respect of Muradin Bronzebeard.
"Oh, yes, sir. I was paying attention," Arthas chuckled. "Good lad, good lad."
Muradin reached up to clap him on the shoulder.
"Now, off with ye. You've taken quite the beating today. You deserve a bit of rest."
His eyes twinkled as he spoke, and Arthas nodded as if agreeing. Today, it was Mirrodin who had taken the beating, and he seemed as happy as Arthas at the fact. The prince's heart suddenly swelled with affection toward the dwarf. Though a strict taskmaster, Mirrodin was someone of whom Arthas had grown terribly fond. He whistled a little as he strode toward his quarters, but then a sudden outburst froze him in his tracks.
No, father! I will not!
Kallia, I grow tired of this conversation. You have no say in this matter.
Papa, please, no!
Arthas edged a little closer to Kallia's chambers. The door was ajar, and he listened, slightly worried. Tyrannus doted on Kallia. What in the world was he asking of her to make her beg with him and use the term of endearment that both she and Arthas had dropped as they grew toward adulthood? Kallia sobbed brokenly. Arthas could take it no longer. He opened the door. I'm sorry, I couldn't help but overhear, but what is wrong? Tyrannus had recently seemed to be acting strangely, and now he looked furious with his 16-year-old daughter.
It is no business of yours, Arthas, Tyrannus rumbled. I have told Kallia something I wish her to do. She will obey me.
Kallia collapsed on the bed, sobbing. Arthas stared from his father to his sister in utter astonishment. Tyrannus muttered something and stormed out. Arthas glanced back at Kallia, then followed his father.
Father, please, what's going on? Do not question me. Kallia's duty is to obey her father.
Tyrannus marched through a door and into a receiving room. Arthas recognized Lord Davil Prestor, a young noble whom Tyrannus seemed to hold in very high regard, and a pair of visiting Dalaran wizards he did not know.
Run along back to your sister, Arthas, and try to calm her. I'll be with you as soon as I can, I promise.
With a final glance at the three visitors, Arthas nodded and went back to Kallia's rooms. His older sister had not moved, although her sobs had quieted somewhat. At a total loss, Arthas simply sat beside her on the bed, feeling awkward. Kallia sat up on the bed, her face wet.
I'm sorry you had to see that, Arthas, but maybe it's for the best.
What did Father want you to do?
He wishes me to marry against my will.
Arthas blinked. Kelly, you're only 16, you're not even old enough to get married. She reached for a handkerchief and dabbed at her swollen eyes.
That's what I said. But Father said it didn't matter. We'd formalize the betrothal, and on my birthday, I'd marry Lord Prestor.
Arthas's sea-green eyes widened in comprehension. So that was why Prestor was here. Well, he began awkwardly, he's very well connected, and I guess he's handsome. Everyone says so. At least he's not some old man.
You don't understand, Arthas. I don't care how well connected or handsome or even kind he is. It's that I don't have any choice in the matter. I'm like your horse. I'm a thing, not a person. To be given away as Father sees fit, to seal a political bargain.
You don't love Prestor?
Love him?
Her blue, bloodshot eyes narrowed in anger.
I barely know him. He's never taken the slightest... Oh, what's the use? I know that this is common practice among royalty and nobility, that we are pawns. But I just never expected Father.
Nor had Arthas. He'd honestly never given much thought to marriage for himself or his sister. He was much more interested in training with Mirrodin and riding invincible. But Kallia was right. It was common among the nobility to make good marriages to ensure their political status. He just never thought his father would sell his daughter like a broodmare.
Kallia, I'm really sorry, he said, and meant it. Is there someone else? Maybe you could convince Father that there's a better match, one that makes you happy as well.
Kallia shook her head bitterly.
It's no use. You heard him.
He didn't ask me.
didn't suggest Lord Prestor.
He ordered me.
She looked at him pleadingly.
Arthas, when you are king, promise me. Promise me you won't do that to your children.
Children?
Arthas was in no way ready to think about that. There weren't even any...
Well, there was, but he hadn't thought about her, and...
And when you marry, Papa cannot order you as he orders me. Make sure you care for this girl, and that she cares for you. Or is at least asked about whom she wants to share her life and her bed with.
She started to weep afresh, but Arthas was too shaken by the revelation that burst upon him. He was only 14 now, but in 4 short years, he'd be of age to wed. He suddenly recalled snatches of conversation he'd heard here and there about the future of the Menethil line. His wife would be the mother of kings. He'd have to choose carefully, but also, as Kalia had asked, kindly. His parents obviously cared greatly for each other. It was reflected in their smiles and gestures, despite many years of marriage. Arthas wanted that. He wanted a companion, a friend. He frowned. But what if he couldn't have that?
I'm sorry, Callie, but maybe you're the lucky one. It might be worse to have the freedom to choose and know that you couldn't have what you wanted.
I would trade that for being a piece of meat in a heartbeat.
We each have our duties, I guess, Arthas said quietly, somberly. You to marry whomever father wants, and me to marry well for the kingdom. He rose abruptly.
I'm sorry, Callie.
Arthas, where are you going?
He didn't answer, but practically raced through the palace to the stables, and without waiting for a groom, quickly saddled Invincible himself. Arthas knew it was only a temporary solution, but he was 14, and a temporary solution was still a solution. He bent low over Invincible's back, the white mane whipping his face as the horse galloped, all sleekly coiled muscle and grace. Arthas's face stretched in a grin. He was never happier than when he rode like this, the two of them merging into one glorious whole. He had waited, his patience sorely tested, for so long to be able to ride the animal he had watched coming into the world, but it had been worth it. They were the perfect team. Invincible wanted nothing from him, asked nothing of him, only seemed to wish to be allowed to escape the confines of the stables as Arthas longed to escape the confines of his royalty. They did so together. They were coming up on the jump Arthas loved now. To the east of Capital City and close to the Balnir farmstead was a small cluster of hills. Invincible surged, the earth devoured by his pounding hooves, pulling himself upward toward the precipice almost as fast as if they were on level ground. He wheeled and turned along the narrow pathways, sending stones scattering with his hooves, his heart and Arthas's both racing in excitement. Then Arthas guided the stallion to the left, over an embankment, a shortcut to the Balnir property. Invincible did not hesitate, had not hesitated, even the first time that Arthas had asked him to leap. He gathered himself and launched forward, and for a glorious, heart-stopping moment, horse and rider were airborne. Then they landed securely on soft, springy grass and were off again. Invincible.
Chapter 4
As you can see, Your Highness, said Lieutenant General Adolus Blackmore, the taxes have been put to good use. Every precaution has been taken in the operation of this facility. In fact, security is so tight, we've been able to stage gladiatorial combat here.
So I've heard, said Arthas, as he walked with the commander of the internment camps on a tour of the grounds. Dernhold, not an internment camp itself, but the nerve center of all the others, was huge, and indeed had almost a festival air about it. It was a crisp but bright autumn day, and the breeze caused the blue and white banners that flew over the keep to snap energetically. The wind stirred Blackmore's long raven hair and tugged at Arthas's cloak as they strolled along the ramparts.
"And so you shall also see," Blackmore promised, giving his prince an ingratiating grin. It had been Arthas's idea for a surprise inspection. Tyrannus had praised Arthas for his initiative and compassion.
"It's only right, father," Arthas had said, and by and large he meant it, although his primary reason for the suggestion was to satisfy his curiosity about the pet orc the lieutenant general kept.
"We should make sure the money is going into the camps and not Blackmore's pocket. We can ascertain if he is taking proper care of the gladiatorial participants, and also make sure he is not walking the path of his father."
Blackmore's father, General Adolin Blackmore, had been a notorious traitor, tried and convicted of selling state secrets. While his crimes had taken place long ago, when his son had been but a child, the stain had dogged Adolus throughout his military career. It was only his record of victory in battles and particular ferocity in fighting the orcs that had enabled the current Blackmore to rise in the ranks. Still, Arthas could detect the smell of liquor on the man's breath, even at this hour of the morning. He suspected that particular piece of information would not be news to Tyrannus, but he'd make sure he told his father anyway. Arthas looked down, feigning interest in watching the dozens of guards who stood at rigid attention. He wondered if they were that attentive when their future king wasn't watching them. "I look forward to the bout today," he said. "Will I be able to watch your thrall in action? I've heard quite a bit about him." Blackmore grinned, his neatly trimmed goatee parting to reveal white teeth.
"He was not scheduled to fight today, but for you, your highness. I shall pair him up against the worthiest foes available."
2 hours later, the tour was complete, and Arthas shared a delicious meal with Blackmore and a younger man named Lord Caramon Langston, whom Blackmore introduced as my protege. Arthas took an instinctive dislike to Langston, noting the man's soft hands and languid demeanor. At least Blackmore had fought in battle for his title. This boy, Arthas thought of him as a boy, although in truth Langston was older than Arthas's 17 years, had been handed everything on a platter. "Well, so have I," he thought, but he also knew what sacrifices a king would be expected to make. Langston looked like he'd never denied himself a thing in his life. Nor did he deny himself now, helping himself to the choicest cuts of meat, the most lavish pastries, and more than one glass of wine to wash it down with. Blackmore, in contrast, ate sparingly, though he had more alcohol than Langston. Arthas's dislike of the pair was completed when their serving girl entered, and Blackmore reached to touch her in a proprietary manner. The girl, golden-haired and simply clad, with a face that needed no artifice to be beautiful, smiled as if she enjoyed it, but Arthas caught a quick flash of unhappiness in her blue eyes.
"This is Taritha Foxton," Blackmore said, one hand still caressing the girl's arm as she gathered the plates. "Daughter of my personal servant, Tamis, whom I'm sure you'll see later."
Arthas gave the girl his most winning smile. She reminded him a bit of Jaina, her hair brightened by the sun, her skin tanned. She returned the smile fleetingly, then demurely looked away as she gathered the plates, dropping a quick curtsy before leaving.
"You'll have one like that soon enough, lad," Blackmore said, laughing. It took Arthas a second to grasp the meaning, and then he blinked, startled.
The two men laughed harder, and Blackmore raised his goblet in a toast.
"To fair-haired girls," he said, in a purring voice.
Arthas looked back at Taritha, thought of Jaina, and forced himself to raise his glass. An hour later, Arthas had forgotten all about Taritha Foxton and his indignation on her behalf. His voice was raw from screaming, his hands hurt from clapping, and he was having the time of his life. At first, he'd felt a little uncomfortable. The first few combatants in the ring were simple beasts pitted against one another, fighting to the death for no reason other than the enjoyment of the onlookers.
"How are they treated prior to this?" Arthas had asked.
He was fond of animals. It unsettled him to see them used so. Langston had opened his mouth, but Blackmore shushed him with a quick gesture. He had smiled, leaning back in his chaise lounge and snagging a bunch of grapes.
"Well, of course, we want them at their fighting peak," he said. "So they are captured and treated quite well. And as you can see, the bouts go quickly. If an animal survives and is not able to continue fighting again, we put him down at once, mercifully."
Arthas hoped the man was not lying to him. A sick feeling in his gut told him Blackmore probably was, but he ignored it. The feeling vanished when the fighting involved men against the beasts. As he watched, riveted, Blackmore said, "The men are paid well. They, in fact, become minor celebrities." Not the orc, though, and Arthas knew it and approved. That's what he was waiting for. The chance to see Blackmore's pet orc found as an infant and raised to be a fighter in these rings, in combat. He was not disappointed. Apparently, everything up until now had been a warm-up for the crowd. When the doors creaked open and a huge green shape strode forward, everyone stood roaring. Somehow, Arthas found himself among them. Thrall was enormous, appearing even larger because he was obviously so much healthier and alert than the other specimens Arthas had seen in the camps. He wore little armor and no helm, and green skin stretched tightly over powerful muscle. Too, he stood straighter than others. The cheering was deafening, and Thrall walked a circle around the ring, lifting his fists, turning his ugly face up to be showered with the rose petals usually reserved for holidays. "I taught him to do that," Blackmore said with pride.
"It's an odd thing, really. The crowd cheers for him, yet they come hoping every time he'll get beaten.
Has he ever lost a bout?"
"Never, Your Highness. Nor will he. Yet people keep hoping, and the money keeps flowing."
Arthas eyed him. "As long as the royal coffers see their proper percentage of your earnings, Lieutenant General, you'll be permitted to continue the games." He turned again to the orc, watching him as he completed his circuit. "He is completely under control, isn't he?"
"Absolutely," Blackmore said immediately. "He was raised by humans and taught to fear and respect us."
As if he had heard the comment, though he could not possibly have done so over the thundering cries of the crowd, Thrall turned to where Arthas, Blackmore, and Langston sat watching. He thumped his chest in a salute, and then bowed deeply.
"You see, utterly my creature," Blackmore purred.
He rose and lifted a flag, waving it, and across the ring, a solidly built, red-haired man waved another flag. Thrall turned toward the door, gripping the massive battle axe that was his weapon in this bout. The guards began to raise the door, and before it had even opened fully, a bear, the size of Invincible, surged forward. Its hackles had risen, and it barreled straight for Thrall, as if it had been launched from a cannon, its snarl audible even over the roar of the crowd. Thrall held his ground, stepping aside at the absolute last minute, and bringing the huge axe around as if it weighed nothing at all. It tore a great rent in the bear's side, and the animal roared in maddened pain, whirling and sending blood spattering. Again the orc stood his ground, resting on the balls of his bare feet, until he moved with a speed that belied his size. He met the bear head-on, shouting taunts in a guttural voice in perfect common, and brought the axe crunching down. The bear's head was nearly severed from its neck, but it kept running for a few moments before toppling into a quivering heap. Thrall threw back his head and cried out his victory. The crowd went mad. Arthas stared. There wasn't a scratch on the orc, and as far as Arthas could tell, the brute wasn't even particularly winded.
"That's just the opener," Blackmore said, smiling at Arthas's reaction. "Next will be three humans attacking him. He's also hampered by the fact that he's not to kill them, just defeat them. More a strategic battle than one of brute force. But I confess, there's something about watching him decapitate a bear in a single blow that always makes me proud."
Three human gladiators, all large, powerfully muscled men, entered the arena and saluted their opponent and the crowd. Arthas watched as Thrall sized them up and wondered just how smart it was of Blackmore to make his pet orc so damn good at fighting. If Thrall ever escaped, he could teach those skills to other orcs. It was possible, despite the increased security. After all, if Orgrim Doomhammer could escape from the Undercity, in the very heart of the palace, Thrall could escape from Dernhold. The state visit lasted 5 days. During one of those days, late in the evening, Taritha Foxton came to visit the prince in his private quarters. He was puzzled that his servants did not answer the tentative knock on the door, and was even more startled to see the pretty blonde girl standing there, carrying a tray of delicacies. Her eyes were downcast, but her dress was revealing enough that he didn't speak immediately. She dropped a curtsy.
"My Lord Blackmore sent me with this offering of things to tempt you," she said. Color suffused her cheeks.
Arthas was confused. "I tell your master thank you, although I am not hungry, and I'm wondering what he's done with my servants."
"They have been invited to a repast with the other servants," Taritha explained.
She still didn't look up. "I see. Well, that's kind of the Lieutenant General. I'm sure the men appreciate it."
She didn't move.
"Is there anything else, Taritha?"
The pink in her cheeks deepened and she lifted her eyes to him. They were calm, resigned. "My Lord Blackmore sent me with this offering of things to tempt you," she repeated. "Things you might enjoy."
Understanding burst upon him then. Understanding and embarrassment and irritation and anger. He composed himself with an effort. It was hardly the girl's fault. Indeed, she was the one being ill-used.
"Taritha," he said, "I'll take the food, with thanks. I need nothing else." "Your Highness, I'm afraid he will insist."
"Tell him I said it's fine."
"Sir, you don't understand. If I come back, he..."
He glanced down at the hands holding the tray, at the long hair draped just so. Arthas stepped forward and lifted her trailing hair out of the way, frowning at the brownish-blue, fading marks on her wrists and throat.
"I see," he said. "Come inside, then."
Once she had entered, he closed the door and turned to her.
"Stay for as long as you feel comfortable, then go back to him. In the meantime, I can't possibly eat all this."
He gestured for her to sit and took a chair opposite her, snagging a small pastry and grinning. Taritha blinked at him. It took a moment for her to understand what he was saying, and then cautious relief and gratitude spread over her face as she poured the wine. After a little while, she began to respond to his questions with more than a few polite words, and they spent the next few hours talking before they agreed it was time for her to return. As she picked up the tray, she turned to him.
"Your Highness, it pleases me so much to know that the man who will be our next king has such a kind heart. The lady you choose to make your queen will be a very lucky woman."
He smiled and closed the door behind her, leaning on it for a moment. The lady he would choose to make his queen.
He recalled his conversation with Kallia. Fortunately for his sister, Terranus had started to have some suspicions about Prestor. Nothing that could be proven, but enough for second thoughts. Arthas was almost of age, a year older than Kallia had been, when their father had nearly betrothed her to Prestor. He supposed he'd have to start thinking about finding a queen sooner or later. Tomorrow he would be leaving, and not a minute too soon. The winter chill was in the air. Autumn's last glorious days were gone, and the trees, once shades of gold and red and orange, were now bare skeletons against a gray sky. In a few more months, Arthas would reach his 19th year and be inducted into the Order of the Silver Hand, and he was more than ready. His training with Muradin had ended a few months ago, and he had now begun sparring with Uther. It was different, but similar. What Muradin had taught was attentiveness and a willingness to win the battle no matter what. The paladins had a more ritualistic way of looking at battle, and focused more on the attitude one brought into the fight than the actual mechanics of swordplay. Arthas found both methods valid, although he was beginning to wonder if he'd ever have the chance to use what he had learned in a true battle. Normally, he'd be in prayer session now, but his father was off on a diplomatic visit to Stromgarde, and Uther had accompanied him, which meant that now Arthas had afternoons free for a few days, and he was not about to waste them, even if the weather was less than perfect. He clung easily and familiarly to Invincible as they galloped over the glade, the animal's stride only slightly slowed by a few inches of snow on the ground. He could see his breath and that of the great white horse as Invincible tossed his head and snorted. It was starting to snow again now, not the soft, fat flakes that drifted lazily down, but small, hard crystals that stung. Arthas frowned and pressed on. A little farther, then he would turn back, he told himself. He might even stop at the Balnir farm. It had been a while since he had been there. Joram and Jerem would likely be interested to see the magnificent horse that the gawky little colt had grown into. The impulse, having struck, now demanded to be obeyed, and Arthas turned Invincible with a subtle pressure from his left leg. The horse wheeled, obedient and completely in tune with his master's desires. The snow was picking up, tiny needles digging into his exposed skin, and Arthas pulled the cape up over his head for a little more protection. Invincible shook his head, his skin twitching as it did when he was being annoyed by insects in the summer. He galloped down the path, stretching his neck forward, enjoying the exertion every bit as much as Arthas. They were coming up on the jump soon, and shortly after that, a warm stable for the steed and a hot mug of tea for his rider before they headed back to the palace. Arthas's face was starting to become numb with the cold, and his hands in their fine leather gloves weren't much better. He tightened his chilled hands over the reins, forcing his fingers to bend, and gathered himself as Invincible leaped. No, he reminded himself, flew. They flew over this jump like... Except they didn't fly. At the last minute, Arthas felt the hideous sensation of Invincible's rear hooves slipping on the icy stone, and the horse flailed, neighing, his legs frantically trying to get a secure footing on thin air. Arthas's throat was suddenly raw, and he realized he was screaming as jagged stone, not smooth, snow-encrusted grass, rushed up to meet them with lethal speed. He pulled hard on the reins, as if that could do something, as if anything could do something. The sound cut through his stupor, and he blinked his way back to consciousness with the bone-chilling shriek of a beast in agony clawing at his brain. He couldn't move at first, though his body spasmed of its own accord, trying to move toward the awful cries. Finally, he was able to sit up. Pain shot through him, and he added his own gasp of agony to the hideous cacophony.
and he realized he'd probably broken at least one rib, probably more. The snow had picked up and was coming down hard and heavy now. He could barely see 3 feet in front of him. He shut out the pain, craning his neck, trying to find Invincible. His eye was drawn to movement and the widening pool of crimson that melted the snow, that steamed in the cold. No, Arthas whispered, and struggled to his feet. The world went black around the edges, and he almost lost consciousness again, but through sheer will, hung on. Slowly, he made his way to the panicked animal, struggling against the pain and the driving wind and snow that threatened to knock him over. Invincible was churning up the bloodied snow with 2 powerful, unharmed rear legs and 2 shattered forelegs. Arthas felt his stomach heave at the sight of the limbs, once so long and straight and clean and powerful, hanging at odd angles as Invincible kept trying and failing to stand. Then the image was mercifully blurred by the snow and the rush of hot tears that spilled down his cheeks. He slogged toward his horse, sobbing, dropping to his knees beside the maddened animal and trying to do what? This was no scratch to be quickly bound so that Invincible could be led to a warm stable in hot mash. Arthas reached for the animal's head, wanting to touch him, to calm him somehow, but Invincible was manic with agony, and he kept screaming. Help! There were priests, and Sir Uther, maybe they could heal? Pain, greater than physical, shot through the youth. The bishop had gone with his father to Stromgard, as had Uther. There might be a priest in another village, but Arthas didn't know where, and with the storm, he shrank back from the animal, covering his ears and closing his eyes, sobbing so that his whole body shook. With the storm, he could never find a healer before Invincible either died of his injuries or froze to death. Arthas wasn't even sure he could find the Balnir homestead, even though it could not be far. The world was white, everywhere save where the dying horse, who had trusted him enough to leap off an icy embankment, lay churning up a steaming crimson pool. Arthas knew what he had to do, and he couldn't do it. He would never know how long he sat there, weeping, trying to shut out the sight and sound of his beloved horse in agony, until finally Invincible's struggles slowed. He lay in the snow, his sides heaving, his eyes rolling in torment. Arthas couldn't feel his face or limbs, but somehow he managed to move toward the beast. Every breath was agony, and he welcomed the pain. This was his fault. His fault. He took the great head in his lap, and for a brief, merciful moment, he wasn't sitting in the snow with a wounded beast, but sitting in a stable while a broodmare gave birth. For that moment, everything was all just beginning, and not coming to this shocking, sickening, avoidable end. His tears fell on the horse's broad cheek. Invincible trembled, his brown eyes wide with now silent pain. Arthas removed his gloves and ran his hand along the pink-gray muzzle, feeling the warmth of Invincible's breath against his hands. Then, slowly, he eased the horse's head from his lap, got to his feet, and fumbled with his warmed hand for his sword. His feet sank in the red puddle of melted snow as he stood over the fallen animal. I'm sorry, he said. I'm so sorry. Invincible regarded him calmly, trustingly, as if he somehow understood what was about to happen and the need for it. It was more than Arthas could bear, and for a moment tears again clouded his vision. He blinked them back. Hard. Arthas lifted the sword and brought it straight down.
He did this right, at least. Pierced Invincible's great heart with a single strong blow from arms that should have been too chilled to do so. He felt the sword